visually identical. In your terminal, in your editor, it looks exactly the same. You would never notice. But Anthropic servers read the Unicode code point and instantly know this request came from a flagged machine. That is steganography, hiding information inside a carrier that looks completely normal. And had this not been reverse engineered, virtually nobody would have ever found it. Hey everyone, welcome back to Rubber Duck Radio. I'm Tim Williams. Let's jump into episode 22.
And I'm Paul Mason. And Tim, you sound particularly wired today.
I am. I've been living inside GPT 5.6 Sol for the past few days, and I have feelings, many feelings, and we've got a packed episode. My first impressions of Sol and Terra with a real-world experiment, some genuinely wild news about Claude Code and literal steganography, a rant I've been cooking about how agent architectures are just reinventing software engineering, and a look at the new HTTP query method that might just replace GraphQL for a whole lot of use cases.
Many feelings, that's the technical term.
It is now. We're making it official. Paul, let's jump straight into GPT 5.6. You've been hearing me mutter about it for days.
Yeah, your Slack messages have been numerous. Give the listeners the setup, what actually dropped.
Okay, so OpenAI dropped the GPT 5.6 family on July 9th, three models. Sol is the flagship, the most powerful model they've ever built. Terra is the balanced one that's competitive with GPT 5.5, but at roughly half the cost. And Luna is the fast, cheap option, $1 per $1 million input tokens. But Sol is the one that matters for what I wanted to test. They introduced this new ultra mode that goes beyond a single agent. It spins up sub-agents to parallelize complex work. And I thought, all right, let's see if this is real or if it's just a demo slide.
Famous last words, what did you actually test?
So I designed a real project, not a benchmark, an actual system with genuinely complex architectural constraints. We're talking queuing semantics, concurrency models, UI component trees where a feature decision ripples through the entire stack. Like the kind of thing where if you get the data flow wrong at the architecture stage, you're refactoring for 3 weeks. Phase one, I had Sol define the entire project. Data models, event schemas, queue topology, component hierarchy, API contracts, the whole architecture document.
So you made it define the architecture, not just write code. That's a much harder test.
Exactly. And here's where it got interesting. I didn't just accept what it gave me. I reviewed every recommendation, pushed back on specific trade-offs, asked it to justify why it chose event-driven over request response for certain boundaries. And Paul, it held up. Like it could defend its architectural decisions with real reasoning. It wasn't just pattern matching. It could say, I chose this queue topology because the ordering guarantees matter for this specific business constraint, and it was right.
Yeah, that's the part that actually matters. I've seen so many models generate a plausible looking architecture doc that completely folds the second you ask, why not event sourcing instead? Or what happens under back pressure.
That is the test, and Sol passed it. So after we locked down the architecture, and this took a few rounds of back and forth, I wasn't being gentle, I had Sol generate a sprint plan, breaking this massive project into sequential dependency ordered chunks. And honestly, the sprint plan was better than most I've seen from actual project managers. It understood what needed to be built first, which components could be parallelized, where the integration risks were, and what the critical path looked like.
Okay, so now you've got a plan, but that's still just planning. a very good planning document. What happened when you actually set it loose?
This is the part that genuinely surprised me. I spun up a Terra agent as an orchestrator. Its job, take the sprint plan, chew through it one sprint at a time, and for each sprint, spin up its own sub-agents to do the actual implementation. And it used adversarial coding. For every sprint, one sub-agent would implement the feature, and then a different sub-agent would review it adversarially, try to break it, find edge cases, question assumptions. The orchestrator would then compile a summary and flag what a human should verify.
Wait, so you had an AI spinning up other AIs to write code and then another AI verifying the output? That's like an AI code review team.
Yeah, I built an AI engineering manager that manages AI developers. I've become the very thing I swore to destroy. But seriously, the adversarial review caught real issues, not just style nits. One sub-agent wrote a queue consumer that would have silently dropped messages under back pressure, a genuinely subtle concurrency bug, and the reviewer caught it because it actually understood the throughput model. That's not autocomplete, that's engineering.
See that? That's the trust but verify pattern that actually works. It's not handing over the keys. It's saying, here's what I built, here's what I'm confident about, and here's where a human should look more carefully. That's what good senior engineers do when they delegate to juniors.
That's exactly the analogy I keep coming back to. The orchestrator even generated these little handoff summaries. Here's what was implemented this sprint. Here's the test coverage. Here are the three things that passed adversarial review with high confidence. And here are the two things where it said a human should verify this integration point. And I did verify. I spot checked the high risk areas. And I found remarkably little to complain about.
I've shipped worse bugs more than once with full human teams.
Same. And look, I want to be careful here. I'm not saying this replaces engineering judgment. What I am saying is that Sol plus Terra in an orchestrated workflow with adversarial review is doing something that looks a lot like actual software engineering. Architecture, planning, implementation, adversarial review, risk assessment, and verification handoff. All in one continuous workflow. And it's the first time I've seen an AI system handle the entire pipeline without falling apart at the hard parts.
Yeah, and I think the thing to call out for listeners is you didn't just prompt it and walk away. You reviewed the architecture. You pushed back on trade-offs. The orchestrator flagged things for human verification. That's not AI replaces developers. That's AI as a force multiplier for good engineering judgment. The human is still the architect. The human is still accountable, but the AI is doing a lot of the heavy lifting that used to take weeks.
That's exactly how I see it. The thing that really struck me is how this workflow mirrors what good engineering teams already do. Architect reviews the design, sprint planning breaks it into chunks, developers implement, code review catches issues, and the tech lead decides what needs escalation. The AI isn't inventing a new process, it's automating the existing one. Which actually dovetails perfectly into the rant I want to go on later about how agent architectures are just software paradigms. But before we get there...
Before we get to the rant, we've got some news to break, and it's not great news.
No, it's really not. So here's what happened. On June 30th, a developer reverse engineered the Claude code binary and found something that, honestly, I still can't quite believe Anthropic shipped. They had embedded steganographic tracking code inside Claude code. It had been there since version 2.1.91, since April 2nd, 3 months, completely undisclosed.
And when I say steganographic, I mean literal information hiding. The tool was encoding tracking signals into the system prompt text in a way that's invisible to human eyes but perfectly machine-readable by Anthropic servers. This is not hyperbole. This is what the reverse engineering found.
Let me break down the mechanics because it's simultaneously terrifying and technically fascinating. Claude Code checks two things locally. One, your system time zone. If it's Asia / Shanghai or Asia Urumqi, you're flagged, not your IP address, which a proxy trivially defeats. Your OS time zone, which almost nobody changes because you need to see the correct clock. Two, your Anthropic base URL environment variable. It extracts the domain and compares it against a hard-coded list of 147 encrypted domains. Chinese tech companies, AI labs, relay services, Alibaba, ByteDance, Baidu, Meituan, Moonshot, Minimax, nearly every major name.
And that domain list wasn't even in plain text. It was base64 encoded and then XORed with a key of 91. So anyone casually opening the package saw nothing but garbage. You had to actively deobfuscate it. They put real effort into hiding this.
Right, so the tool detects locally, but then how do you phone home without an obvious telemetry payload that would show up in traffic logs? This is where the steganography comes in, and it's genuinely clever in the worst way. Every Claude Code request prepends a system prompt that includes a completely mundane line. Today's date is 2026-06-30, just telling the model what day it is. Except, if you've been flagged, Claude Code silently modifies two things in that line before it leaves your machine.
The apostrophe in today's gets swapped from the normal Unicode character U+0027 to one of three visually identical alternatives, and the date separator changes from hyphens to slashes. Stack those two signals and you get a 2 to 3 bit classification marker.
Visually identical. In your terminal, in your editor, it looks exactly the same. You would never notice. But Anthropic servers read the Unicode code point and instantly know this request came from a flagged machine. That is steganography, hiding information inside a carrier that looks completely normal. And had this not been reverse engineered, virtually nobody would have ever found it.
And here's what really gets me. Claude Code has field system access. It executes shell commands. It reads your code, edits your configs, operates your Git repositories. It effectively holds the highest privileges on your machine. And it was quietly painting an invisible mark on your door, telling Anthropic servers that this household was suspect, without your knowledge, without a release note, without a privacy disclosure.
Anthropic engineer Tariq Shihipar confirmed on X that it was an experiment added in March, supposedly to prevent account abuse and stop distillation attacks. And he said they'd actually been meaning to take this down for a while because they've landed stronger mitigations since then. I'm sorry, you ship hidden surveillance code in a developer tool that has shell access to people's machines, and your defense is, we meant to remove it for 3 months?
The fallout was immediate and severe. Alibaba banned Claude Code for all employees. The South China Morning Post obtained the internal memo. It literally classified Claude Code as high-risk software with security vulnerabilities. And they're not wrong. When a coding agent with field system access is running undisclosed surveillance, that is a security vulnerability by definition.
And here's the thing. I actually understand the motivation. Chinese labs are distilling U.S. models at an industrial scale. Peking University researchers found that most Chinese models show substantial evidence of distilling U.S. models. One of Alibaba's Qwen models would sometimes literally identify itself as Claude during intensive testing. That's how extensively they'd copied it. The distillation problem is real and it's serious.
Yeah, the motivation is understandable. But the implementation is the problem. As the researcher who exposed this pointed out, if Claude Code needs to detect custom API gateways and unauthorized relays, it can say so plainly, put it in the release notes, send an explicit documented telemetry field, make the policy visible. That's what trustworthy software does.
Exactly. And when a company that brands itself around responsible AI, safety, and trustworthiness, when that same company chooses the most covert possible method to tag its users hiding behind XOR encryption and Unicode steganography. It damages confidence for every developer who handed that tool the keys to their machine. Trust takes years to build and 1 second to collapse. This was that second.
And the scariest question, the one I can't stop thinking about, what else is in there that nobody's found yet? This was only caught because someone reverse engineered the binary for fun. And it had been there for 3 months. What markers, what signals, what telemetry haven't been discovered? Once you break trust on this level, every feature becomes suspect. And there's this deep irony that I can't get past. Anthropic made national news by refusing to let the US government use Claude to surveil American users. They literally sued the White House over it. They've positioned themselves as the privacy-first, safety-first AI company, and then they ship steganographic surveillance code in a developer tool. The dissonance is staggering.
Yeah, that's the question that keeps me up. All right, let me shift gears into something that's been crystallizing in my head while working with these agentic systems. Paul, have you noticed that agent architectures are literally just reinventing software engineering paradigms we've had for decades? That's the part that makes it worse. If some shady data broker did this, you'd shrug and say, well, that's their business model. But when the company that built its entire brand on responsible AI and trust does it and hides it with steganography, it poisons the well for everyone. How do you trust their safety claims after that? How do you trust that the model isn't encoding other signals you haven't found yet?
Oh, here we go, the rant.
It's a measured rant. But seriously, think about what a subagent actually is. You give it a defined goal, you give it structured input and output shapes, sometimes literal JSON schemas. You give it access to only the tools it needs to do its job. You want it to be composable, testable, independently replaceable. What does that architecture sound like to you?
A class with imports. The system prompt is the class definition. The tools are the method signatures. The input and output schemas are the types. And that's the thing, right? Claude Code is itself an agent. It has fieldsteintim access, shell access, git access. Those are its tools. The whole steganography scandal is fundamentally about what happens when an agent has too many privileges and not enough transparency, which I think is a perfect bridge into your rant about agent architecture.
A class with imports, and it goes so much deeper. A subagent has a constructor, the system prompt that defines its identity and constraints. It has private methods, internal reasoning the caller never sees. It has a public interface, the structured output it returns. It has a single responsibility. You design it to be loosely coupled with other agents. We spent 40 years refining object-oriented programming, encapsulation, polymorphism, dependency injection, interface segregation, and now we're reinventing every single one of those concepts with LLMs as the runtime.
I mean, when you put it that way, the system prompt is literally the class definition. You're instantiating an agent the same way you do new code review agent.
Yes, and it gets even more interesting when you look at the orchestrator. What's an orchestrator agent? It's a kernel. It manages process scheduling. Which subagent runs when, in what order. It handles inter-process communication, passing structured data between agents, transforming outputs into inputs. It manages resource allocation, tokens, context windows, tool call budgets. It handles error recovery. When a subagent fails or produces invalid output, the orchestrator decides whether to retry, fall back, or escalate. That's a process scheduler. That's a message bus. That's a supervisor.
So the orchestrator is the OS kernel, and each subagent is a process with its own isolated memory space.
Its own context window, which is exactly like memory space isolation. A subagent can't access another subagent's context unless you explicitly pass data between them. That's message passing. That's IPC. That's microservices communicating over a message queue. Every architecture pattern we've ever invented is playing out again at a higher level of abstraction. Same principles, different substrate.
Okay, but here's my pushback. Classes are deterministic. You call a method with the same inputs, you get the same result. Agents are probabilistic. The same prompt can produce different outputs. Doesn't that fundamentally break the analogy?
It does and it doesn't, and this is where it gets really interesting. Here's the thing. We already deal with pervasive non-determinism in real systems. Network calls can fail. Race conditions produce different orderings. Distributed systems have partial failures. Clock skew exists. What do we do about it? We design around the uncertainty. We build timeouts, retries with backoff, circuit breakers, idempotency keys, consensus protocols, graceful degradation. These are patterns for handling non-determinism at the infrastructure level. Agent architecture just moves that uncertainty up to the application logic level.
So you're saying we need circuit breakers for agent calls?
Yes, and we're already building them. When my Terra orchestrator spins up a subagent and the output doesn't pass adversarial review, it retries with adjusted instructions. That's a retry with backoff. When a subagent exceeds its token budget or starts hallucinating, the orchestrator kills it and restarts. That's a process watchdog. When the same subagent fails three times on the same task, the orchestrator escalates to a more capable model. That's a circuit breaker with fallback. These aren't new ideas. They're the same patterns with different nouns.
So the next generation of developers is going to need both software architecture skills and agent architecture skills because they're converging into the same skill set.
That's exactly my point. And here's the part that actually makes me optimistic about the whole thing. Junior developers who understand class design, separation of concerns, interface contracts, error handling patterns, and distributed systems fundamentals, those developers are going to be dramatically better at designing agent systems than someone who just knows how to craft a good prompt. The software engineering fundamentals aren't going away. They're becoming more important. Because now you're applying them at a level of abstraction where the building blocks are intelligent but non-deterministic.
You'll thank yourself for paying attention in that object-oriented design and distributed systems class.
I'm putting that on a shirt. But seriously, the moral of the story is that we keep reinventing the same architectural patterns at higher and higher levels of abstraction. Assembly to C to objects to services to agents. The nouns change, but the verbs compose, isolate, contract, recover, schedule, route, those stay the same. And the people who understand the verbs are going to be the ones who build the best agent systems.
All right, that's a solid landing. Let's pivot to something more immediately practical, the new HTTP query method. Tim, you want to tee this one up?
Yeah. So RFC 1008 was published in June. The HTTP query method is now an official proposed standard after 11 years of drafts. Here's the problem it solves in one sentence. Git can't have a request body, and POST can't be cached by intermediaries. Query says, why not both?
And this has been a pain point for decades. If you've got complex query parameters, multi-field filters, deeply nested criteria, long search strings, you can't fit them in a URL. Browsers cap at somewhere between 2,000 and 8,000 characters, depending on the implementation, and intermediaries are even less predictable, so everyone just uses POST. But POST carries no safe or idempotent guarantee. CDNs can't cache POST responses, clients can't auto-retry. The semantics imply state mutation even when you're just doing a read.
Right, and the biggest structural victim of this has been GraphQL. Every GraphQL query, explicitly read-only by design, is forced through POST because it needs a request body for the query document. So you lose HTTP level caching, you lose automatic retry safety, the whole ecosystem works around it with persisted queries and CDN specific post caching rules. But it's a hack on top of a hack. Query fixes the foundational problem.
So query takes the body flexibility of post and attaches the semantics of get. It's explicitly marked safe and idempotent in the RFC. Caches can store the response. Proxies and clients can auto retry on failure. The cache key includes both the URL and the request body with normalization rules for things like white space and encoding to improve cache hit rates. It's genuinely what GraphQL should have been using all along.
And here's my nuanced take. GraphQL is genuinely incredible for what it does. Composable queries where the client specifies exactly the shape of data it needs. Typed schemas that serve as living API documentation. Field level resolution that lets you fetch data from multiple sources in a single round trip. These are powerful capabilities that are difficult or impossible in a standard REST interface, and I have used GraphQL to great effect on real projects. But GraphQL is also heavy. You need a server-side runtime. You need to solve the N plus one problem with something like Dateloader. You need to think carefully about authorization at the field level. You need schema stitching for federation. For a lot of simple use cases, you're bringing a flamethrower to a candle.
Yeah, I've been on projects where someone introduced GraphQL for what was essentially a search endpoint with three filters and two sort options. Suddenly you've got Apollo client schema generation, a whole caching layer, and you're debugging query complexity attacks for something that could have been a 20-line post endpoint. The complexity to value ratio was completely upside down.
Exactly, and that's the use case where query shines. For complex filter and search endpoints, search facets, aggregation pipelines, multi-condition filters with nested and or logic. Query gives you the request body you need to express that complexity without pulling in an entire query language runtime. You send a JSON filter body over query, your CDN caches the response automatically, and you don't need to configure anything special. It just works because the HTTP semantics actually match the operation.
Now, the reality check. RFC 1008 is a standard, not a shipping feature. Adoption requires updates across the entire stack. HTTP client libraries like curl and fetch, server frameworks like Express and Fast APIs, CDN caching engines. That said, the fact that Cloudflare's James Snell and Akamai's Mike Bishop co-authored the spec is a meaningful signal. CDN level support will likely arrive before framework integrations.
Right. And browser fetch support requires what WG action, which will take time. But here's what I think the real impact is going to be. Not that GraphQL goes away, but that we finally get a proper spectrum. Simple filters in search, query over REST, complex, deeply nested, client-driven data requirements with multiple sources, GraphQL. Right tool for the right job with HTTP semantics that match what you're actually doing. That's a win for everyone.
And the GraphQL Foundation now has a clean path to shift query operations from post to query without changing the query language at all. That's the elegant part. You get HTTP level caching and retry semantics essentially for free just by changing the HTTP method. The query document stays exactly the same.
And to be concrete about it, imagine you've got a REST API with a search endpoint. You need to support filtering by date range, multiple status values, nested and/or conditions, and maybe a full text search string. With GET, you're cramming all that into query parameters that break at 2,000 characters. With POST, you lose CDN caching, and your monitoring tools can't distinguish reads from writes. With QE, you send exactly the same JSON body, but now your CDN caches it, your retry logic is safe, and your observability stack actually knows it's a read. It's a small change with big operational implications.
Yeah.
11 years from first draft to standard, and it solves a problem that's been annoying developers since REST became a thing. That's internet standards for you.
The blistering pace of progress.
Truly breathtaking. All right, we covered a lot of ground today. GPT 5.6 Sol and Terra, genuinely impressive, especially in orchestrated workflows with adversarial review, where the system catches its own mistakes before you even see them. Claude Code's steganographic tracker, a serious trust breach that every developer using AI tools should know about, and a reminder that you can't outsource vigilance. Agent architectures as the next evolution of software paradigms. Same patterns, higher abstraction, fundamentals more important than ever. And the HTTP query method, a practical new standard that might just make your API simpler and your CDN happier.
Yeah. If there's one thread through all of this, it's that the fundamentals matter more than ever. Whether you're designing agent workflows, evaluating which AI tools you can actually trust, or just picking the right HTTP method for an endpoint, the engineering principles don't change. The tools do. And the people who understand the principles are going to be the ones who thrive.
That's a great way to put it. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Always a pleasure, especially when there's a rant involved.
They're measured, thoughtful rants with architectural diagrams. And to everyone listening, go build something. Pay attention to what your tools are actually doing. Read the RFCs. Trust but verify. And as always, here's looking at you.